Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. Growing up in the Midwest, Michael Tisserand loved reading comics. His gateway drug was comic books. But one day while hanging out at the Willard Library in Evansville, Indiana, he discovered a section that featured newspaper comic strips. To this day, he remembers that section so clearly, he still knows its Dewey Decimal designation, 741.5. It was there that Tisserand discovered old comic strips like Dick Tracy and the Cats and Jammer Kids. But Peanuts, which he read every day in the newspaper, soon became his real favorite. When he was in his early 20s, Tisserand discovered Crazy Cat. And when he moved to New Orleans, his fascination grew because he learned that Crazy Cat's brilliant creator, George Harriman, had a mysterious past that linked him as a young boy to Treme, a largely African-American and Creole community in the city. It was then that the seeds for his book, Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White, were sown. It's a biography that reveals Harriman's closely guarded secret. He was born into a Creole family, but passed for white his entire life. The book also exposes those of us who don't know much about Crazy Cat to the strip itself. It was a masterpiece, a remarkable work of art that took inspiration from surrealist painters. It was a mind-bending commentary on race, gender, and hypocrisy. And it was a strip that influenced generations of comic artists to follow. Charles Schulz, the creator of Tisserand's beloved Peanuts, once said that his ambition was, quote, to draw a strip that would have as much life and meaning and subtlety as Crazy Cat. Michael Tisserand, welcome to Two-Way Street.
I'm really happy to be here, Bill. Thanks for bringing me on to talk about Crazy Cat and George Harriman.
I suspect that there are listeners of ours who, like me, have not been terribly familiar with Crazy Cat and the world that Harriman created for Crazy Cat to live in. I found you have a quote, though, that I think helps us understand why Crazy Cat became so important in so many ways. You said at one point, Harriman was talking about race and identity as profoundly as anyone has, in my opinion, but I never see that as his big topic, and you put topic in an uppercase T. It was just part of his world and the world he created, even if others were slow to recognize it. And just from that quote alone, you tell us that Crazy Cat is culturally was really important to this country during those years he was writing it, yeah?
I think Crazy Cat is, yes, absolutely. And I think Crazy Cat is still incredibly important to this country. I think that we're still having conversations that Harriman contributed so much to when he was working in the teens and 20s and 30s and 40s about the elasticity of social identity, about the unreliability of language to try to pin people down to a certain race or a certain gender or a certain identity at all. All these things we're wrestling with now were topics for Harriman to play with great artistry and great unpredictability.
Give us a basic, very simple description of what Crazy Cat was. Who were the main characters? What were the sort of plot lines? And let's just establish that, and then let's put Crazy Cat in the context of what was happening in cartooning during that whole period of time.
Right, so Crazy Cat the strip, just like, you know, I would pick up Peanuts and read about Charlie Brown in the funny pages. Crazy Cat as a strip was in the funny pages from 1913 as a named strip to Harriman's death in 1944, especially when the William Hearst newspapers, but also King Features syndicated to other papers. And it confused people because Crazy Cat is a black cat that frequently changes color. Might walk into a beauty parlor and come out white, and doesn't only change gender, but really is non-binary, is both male and female or something else that's not necessarily nameable in the strip at that time. A strip might have Crazy Cat saying, I may take a husband, or maybe I'll take a wife, and that would be the strip. And and Ignatz Mouse, this little white mouse, and Officer Pup, who was an officer of the law, in Coconino County, which is Harriman's recreation of northern Arizona and southern Utah, Monument Valley area especially. You see the mittens that you might know from John Ford movies. You see the mittens show up in all these beautiful landforms of northern Arizona, a place that Harriman loved. And Ignatz is obsessed with throwing a brick at the cat.
maybe not every strip, but that is probably the most common action in any Crazy Cat cartoon, is Ignatz the mouse, who I think detests Crazy Cat's, what he sees as his naivete, his lack of knowledge of the world. So he throws a brick at him constantly, right?
Throws a brick constantly. to get into the motivations of Ignatz would be another book, possibly. But certainly the naivete, or whenever Crazy Cat says something that Ignatz perceives as being silly or stupid, the brick comes out. Now, in the beginning of the strip, in the early teens, Crazy would not be happy about this. But sometime in the 1917, 1918, Crazy Cat started to interpret these bricks as a sign of Ignatz's great devotion and love.
Yeah.
So that naivete you mentioned sort of wins out in the strip, and Crazy Cat, true love conquers all, at least in the heart of Crazy Cat.
Okay.
We should say here cat with a K, K-A-T,
right.
Which is
K for crazy, K for cat.
Exactly.
Crazy Cat loves Ignatz. But Ignatz...
Little Dalek.
Yeah, we need to point out that the language, you have to actually see on the page the spellings that Harriman uses, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. But so Crazy Cat loves Ignatz. Ignatz despises Crazy Cat, throws bricks at him with some...
But then just Bill, he always complicates it because, yeah, Ignatz despises Crazy Cat, but then sometimes you see them lying in bed together, you see this, I don't know, frenemy, I guess, is what you say now?
I think Harriman is nothing if not ambiguous.
Right.
The third character who comes into play here is Officer Pup. Who is he?
Officer Pup is the officer of the law sworn to uphold the law, which means that mice should not throw bricks at Crazy Cat. And when Officer Pup sees this brick pop out and make an appearance, or even imagines that Ignatz is imagining a brick, Officer Pup hustles Ignatz into the Coconino County Jail. Officer Pup holds his own secret, which is that Officer Pup also is madly in love with Crazy Cat, although that barely, longtime readers of the strip don't even see that all the time. So it only comes out once in a while and very, very sort of in the subtext. But Officer Pup does love Crazy as well.
Okay, with that in mind, let's go back and look at Harriman's career leading up to Crazy Cat, which you lay out so beautifully in your book. Harriman had been in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Harriman grew up in Treme in New Orleans. He was what in those days was called colored. He came from a family that was colored.
Free people of color was one of the many designations they received, yeah.
But the family ends up moving to California. And how old was Harriman?
He was about 10 years old.
So they moved to California, and suddenly, because they can pass, Harriman no longer describes himself or tries to behave as if he is, in fact, a person of color.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hidden for years.
It's really hidden all of his life.
Yeah.
It's really hidden until 30 years after his death, when a birth certificate is located that reveals in parentheses, the word colored, closed parentheses on the end of the birth certificate. And the writer, Ishmael Reed, saw a news account about that discovery and dedicated his book Mumbo Jumbo to George Harriman, Afro-Creole cartoonist. And the story started to come out and people started to reevaluate Crazy Cat and start to, which was a project that I've continued in this book, started to try to read his strips in light of his unique biography.
But as he goes to work for newspapers first in Los Angeles, he goes to New York, people around him in the newsrooms, they kind of joke quietly about his heritage. they decide that he to talk about him as Greek.
Yeah, that's just that. Yeah, it's just wonderful. George the Greek. He had this friend, Tad Dorgan, an amazing figure in American comics and American literature, a sports cartoonist known for popularizing and inventing all kinds of slang from Yes, We Have No Bananas to 23 Skidoo to Dumb Dora to all these phrases came from Tad Dorgan's comics. And Tad was sort of the ringleader of the cartoonists. And he wrote an essay in which George Harriman showed up. And we didn't know what to call him, so we called him George the Greek, which kind of says it all right there. It was almost as if he was creating a cover story for Harriman. We're not going to worry about this. We're going to call him the Greek. He became George the Greek or the Greek for the rest of his life.
Yeah, but what always was troubling for him is the fact that everyone recognized that he had what they described as kinky hair. And yeah. There was a lot of joking quietly about his kinky hair to the extent he finally started wearing a hat everywhere he went, indoors and outdoors.
Yeah, you know, and racial passing is still, for very obvious reasons, still an open wound and still something that writers and are wrestling with. There's a terrific book of essays, including this writer named Gabriel Balot, who wrote about Crazy Cat for The New Yorker. That just came out about racial passing, and there's some other really great works about it. And one line that comes to me is that the story of racial passing is always a story of loss, you know, of what you gave up of yourself in order to make this decision. And of course, the decision for Harriman was made for him. He was 10 years old when he moved with his family to Los Angeles. I don't know to the extent that Harriman was nervous or concerned or feared. Being uncovered. There were jokes. I found jokes in the newspapers at that time about George Harriman's kinky hair. There was actually a joke that one of his friends made about rubbing his kinky locks for good luck, which kind of goes back to sort of a racist folklore about rubbing the head of an enslaved person for good luck. So that stuff was in the air and even in print sometimes. And George Harriman did wear a hat. And then in Crazy Cat, among the many, many, many references to race is Crazy Cat's crooked tail and kinky tail. And even there's jokes about Crazy Cat getting Crazy's tail marcelled and straightened out.
Yeah, you point out, and you have great dialogue in the book, Crazy Cat, gosh, what a kinky tail, Ignatz says. Kinky my elbow, says Crazy. I just had it marcelled.
Exactly. It's amazing what he put into the strip, things that I mean, he was married to a white woman. He was living in a house at the end of his life that he could not legally be living in because there was a racial covenant attached to the house. So throughout his life, even though he had gained some celebrity and quite a bit of status, especially among intelligentsia in the New York literary and art world, he was still kind of on a tightrope his whole life.
And it comes through in the strip. You tell us that in some of the strips there are gags about little, and again, the spelling is crucial here, Ethiopian, spelled E-E-T-I-Y-O-P-A-N, mice. At one point, Ignatz turns black and is shunned by Crazy. Crazy turns white, and Ignatz becomes infatuated. In another strip, you tell us, a black Ignatz and a white Crazy Cat regard themselves in shock and then transform into their original colors and wake up in a bed together as if they've just shared a dream. I mean, there's no question that Harriman is playing out the dilemma of his life in the pages of Crazy Cat, in the cells of Crazy Cat.
Exactly right. I like the use of that word cells there. It wasn't just the shifts of color, because you see that, you know, Harriman was also influenced by slapstick comedies, and you might see a guy walk under a big bucket of whitewash or a bag of flour and turn white and run around, and everyone says that's a ghost or something like that. You see those kind of gags, but there's this qualitative sense of Crazy's character and this shift of emotions that occur between Ignatz and Crazy. One of my favorite strips is this. Café du Monde, right here in New Orleans, was serving up café au lait when Harriman was a child, certainly walking around the French Quarter on his way to the tailor shop and elsewhere with his parents. And there's a strip in which Crazy is in the kitchen, and Ignatz says, and Ignatz is on the floor of a restaurant, of a cafe, and says, large coffee black. And Crazy says, large coffee black, and sends the coffee out to the counter. And Ignatz says, this coffee's not black. And Crazy says, sure it is. Look under the milk. You know, I never want to ascribe Harriman's intent. I always try to back off in this book of saying Harriman was trying to talk about himself, or Harriman was, Harriman sat down and said, how can I just, you know, but you read it, and that is, I cannot think of a stronger and more potent metaphor for what Harriman lived than that comic.
At around the turn of the century, comic artists played very different kinds of roles than we're used to thinking of them as doing today. They would go out and they would draw sporting events. They would go out and cover a crime. They'd go to the courtrooms. And you talk about how he portrayed blacks and that he himself turned to the overt racial stereotyping that other artists were using, the kind of minstrel-like characters. You talk about one called the Colored Republicans Hold a Jubilee, and it's filled with those racial stereotypes, yes?
Yeah, it is, and it's difficult to look at. It hurts to see some of, early cartooning was shared a lot with minstrel shows. And in fact, early daily Crazy Cat strips basically recreate minstrel shows gags on the page. And Harriman this is comics that Harriman was drawing, cartoons and comics, when he was 18 years old. So he was really learning the language of comics. And part of the language at that time was depicting African Americans in sort of subhuman, inky black, sort of, you know, monstrous ways. And that was part of, that's the language that Harriman learned as he became a cartoonist and as he sought out to pursue cartooning as a career, which makes it stunning. By the time he's 22, he uses the same convention for this comic, Musical Moes, which is it's a short run comic. I think it lasted 5 or 6 episodes. And it's about this character. Again, if you look at the character, it is as awful of a picture as you can imagine. But Musical Moes is a black musician, and he's a really, really good musician. He sets out and says, I'm going to do an impersonation. And he sets out to be an Irishman or sets out to be an Italian. And he makes music. And because he's so good, he's beloved. And then the people who are listening to his music, the Irish crowd, the Italian crowd, whoever, sees Moes, and they beat him up. They pummel him down to the ground. And in one strip, you just hear this voice coming out of a Musical Moes saying, oh, I wish my color would fade. So it's really remarkable work for a 22-year-old.
So Harriman moved from one newspaper to another, drawing for a variety of newspapers, Pulitzer, Hearst, whatever.
Especially Hearst.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And in fact, his first comic for Hearst, his first drawing for Hearst, you tell us, was in the beginning of 1901. And you give us a great example of the intellect at work in George Harriman. So you describe an unsigned gag that you attribute to him, which takes aim at a favorite target of his, social pretension. Do you mind if I read to you what you say about that?
Please do.
One of those cartoons. In one panel, a couple is dining at a restaurant. The woman asks the man if he is fond of Ibsen. He replies that he is and suggests that she order some. And right. Another panel introduces a Professor Bugs, who stands over a hole in the earth and holding a bone in his right hand, pronounces it might be the remains of a glyptodon or a megatherium. His daughter looks down at the hole. Why, Papa, that's where we buried poor Rover. Those are just remarkable.
They stay funny. For anybody who's been at a cocktail party and someone was talking about something they didn't know what it was and you nod along hoping to fake your way through the conversation, those cartoons are still funny.
Well, and also I would bet you we could probably count on one hand, maybe two hands, the number of times that Ibsen has appeared in a newspaper
right.
comic strip.
Well, absolutely. And one thing, as you know, Harriman always stayed a step ahead of me, and I had to read and reread a lot of literature to understand what Harriman was doing in the comics. Cervantes' Don Quixote, Don Quixote, almost said the Man of La Mancha, shows where I came at the literature from first, was a favorite novel of Harriman's. He read it when he was in school. Shakespeare shows up constantly, Ibsen, and all these works that I would see a phrase and thankfully could go to the internet and figure out what Harriman was doing.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, more with Michael Tisserand on Crazy Cat and its creator, George Harriman. This is Two-Way Street. Just joining us, my guest today is Michael Tisserand. We're talking about his book, Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White. From 1913 to 1944, Harriman drew the comic strip Crazy Cat. It was a brilliant creation that has influenced generations of artists to this day. And all the while that Harriman was using the strip to comment on divisive issues like race and class, he was hiding a secret he took to his grave. He passed for white, despite the fact he was a person of color, born into a Creole family in New Orleans. He created a character at one point early in his career named Major Ozone. Who was Major Ozone?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the most quixotic character of all of Harriman's characters. Major Ozone was my favorite, actually, of all of his pre-Crazy Cat strips. Yeah, Major Ozone and Baron Mooch. Who came a little later, but Major Ozone is the full name is Major Ozone's Fresh Air Crusade, and there was sort of a time of health fads and quacks, I think they were called at that time, and he was parodying those characters with this man Major Ozone, who was an older, thin gentleman, who would do anything to find and get fresh air. So not the radio show, but the actual fresh air. And he would open a window, even if he was in a submarine underwater and the fish in the water would pour in. He would climb up to the top of a smokestack, and you'd see in the next strips, the workers were taking the scaffolding down, and he was stuck up on top and saying, oh, well, the air is fresh. And every strip was Major Ozone seeking fresh air. It's a really lovely strip. I think that one also holds up really nicely 100 years later.
Where do you imagine that came from? Have you given that thought?
You know, he was doing cartoonists at that time. This was before photography really took over newspapers, and he was illustrating news stories, and he went down to a convention, and there were a lot of health quacks, I think it was called at that time, at that convention, and he did a lot of comics lampooning them, and I think it was a combination of that, and as well as reading Don Quixote, and Major Ozone really does come off as this quixotic figure, and there is this comic character, this cartoon character of someone on a quest, obsessed with some certain outcome, the same way that Ignatz later on be obsessed with throwing the brick. And that's sort of a comic trope at that time, and still is. So I think he was also just looking for a hit character at this time. You know, the Yellow Kid and Happy Hooligan and the Cats and Jammer Kids, These aren't just old comics. These were used to sell products. They were big hits. And Harriman was a 22-year-old, 23-year-old trying to find one of those kind of characters. He later dismissed these characters, saying, "Well, I tried a lot and they always failed." But those failures were lovely.
Well, just as an example of how important cartoons could be to driving sales, on Saturday, October 17th, 1896, New York Journal readers open their papers, you tell us, and there is, in all caps, "The Yellow Kid tomorrow, moving into to the New York Journal." And it goes on to talk about the fact that the journal is going to have 8 full pages of color that make the kaleidoscope pale with envy. They were big business.
I'm going to make a pitch for a book that's not mine. It's Sunday Press Publishing produces these books of reproductions of early comics, the size that readers originally beheld these comics. And there's one called Society as Nix, Anarchy in Early Comics. And it really gives you an idea. These cartoonists were inventing a language and were just drunk on imagery, and everything went on these pages, and they're lovely. They weren't, you know, held to 8 panels in a row on the top half of a page, on the top half of a forever shrinking page, but instead could open up in the full majesty. And when the color printers came around, there was a battle between some of the people who wanted it for fashion pages and some who wanted it for comics pages. And happily, the comics pages more, at least sometimes, won out.
He went on, Harriman did, and created another strip. As you say, he was looking for a big hit. And so he kept finding new ideas. He went out and created something called Mary's Home from College, which I think was in Hearst papers across the country. Right. Mary literally is coming back from college. She is described as the collegely, collegely, educated daughter. What was fun about Mary and her family?
Mary would come home and be very embarrassed about her sort of working class family, working class parents, and would start to, you know, bring these professors and these, you know, these kids from college, from wealthier families, and philosophers, and the father, she would poo-poo her father's mustache or beard or something like that, and say, "There's, you know, you have microbes in your facial hair, papa," and so it was sort of a little bit of a family conflict, especially a class conflict.
So we should point out that the cells in many of the comics of the day were crowded with images and in some cases thought bubbles, little dialogue here and there, and certainly Harriman did that. And in Mary's Home from College, we suddenly see the appearance at the bottom of the panels of a white dog and a black cat who are carrying on their own conversation while the main action of the strip is unfolding. And this is when Harriman really starts developing an interest in drawing animals, or when his interest in drawing animals really accelerates.
Right. There had been some animals. He had a black cat that showed up in the margins of strips almost from the very, very beginning of his work. But here they start to really develop characters and play their own scenes. They start to quote Shakespeare back and forth at each other, and they have their own little life. And this is part of the glory of newspaper comics at that time, that they were so large you could fill them up with all kinds of little content. And sometimes that content would take on a life of its own. He had been covering boxing. And at that time, there was a big controversy over the boxing color line. Which was that white boxers were refusing to go in the ring with black boxers. And the Hearst cartoonists and sports cartoonists especially saw right through this and saw that these boxers knew that they would get beat, that there were some really superior black boxers, Joe Gans, Sam Langford, and especially Jack Johnson. And they would do comic after comic about this. And Harriman started to draw these black boxers as cats. And this is where you first start to see that character of Crazy Cat, that sort of anthropomorphic character, really start to emerge. And then when Mary's Home from College and these other strips start to come, those little cats in the corner of Mary's family's house, and those caricatures of boxers start to emerge, and that's where Crazy Cat is born.
In 1910, boxing world finally found a white fighter, Jim Jeffries, who would step into the ring with the great Jack Johnson. And this fight, of course, became an enormously iconic event at the time and the focal point of a lot of racial animosity.
Extraordinary amount, yes.
Yeah, and Harriman began really commenting on this fight. So Johnson beats Jeffries. And I think it's fascinating because in the pages of The Examiner, where Harriman was working at the time, there were a lot of people who were echoing the racist sentiment of Jim Jeffries' loss to a black man, including Jack London, the great American writer, To Build a Fire, is the story most people remember him for, but he wrote many others. Even Jack London expressed enormous racist sentiment around this fight.
He led the charge. Yeah, you know, Jim Jeffries had been the heavyweight champion before, and he seemed quite happy to be tending an alfalfa farm, and he had a saloon in Los Angeles, and Harriman said he had a few strips of bacon around his girth at that point. He was way out of fighting shape, and Jack London led the charge and over again called on Jim Jeffries to get back in the ring and reclaim the heavyweight champion crown for the white race, for the glory of the white race. This was very explicit at that time.
But it's Harriman who I think has the most profound response to the fight. He draws a pen and ink minstrel show that he calls Uncle Tom's Cabin. What does he do with that cartoon?
Right. Well, that's, you know, Uncle Tom's Cabin would have been seen not just as a work of literature at that time, but as a minstrel show. There were Uncle Tom's Cabin minstrel shows on the stage and very popular at that time. And it's, again, this idea, just like with Musical Moe's, of Harriman taking all this material and doing something very original with it. He drew a comic called Uncle Tom's Cabin 1910, where Uncle Tom is punching out Simon Legree and saying times have changed.
Times have changed. And he spelled it H-A-B.
Hab, right. He's using dialect. Yeah. Times have changed. You're right.
So the George Harriman, who some years earlier, had been going into criminal courts and painting what can only be described as racially insensitive images of black defendants, is now, I think, championing Jack Johnson in that particular cartoon, although you never can tell what his thinking was there.
Well, he was championing. He knew Jack Johnson, and he would have met Jack Johnson. He knew Jim Jeffries. They were part of the sporting world. Something happened between age 20 and age 30 there for Harriman, and I speculate that part of it was being in the newsroom with people like Tad Dorgan, who were incredibly independent thinkers, and Jimmy Swinnerton, also another cartoonist who was a big influence on Harriman. I would not say they were woke. I would not say they were enlightened. If one of them popped up in this conversation right now, they might say things that would startle us as being insensitive. But for their time, I would say they were stunningly independent thinkers. So I think that Harriman was perhaps emboldened in part by being with other people who could see through this national, racially based hysteria surrounding this fight, and could actually talk about something so radical as who's the better boxer, independent of race.
Let's take another break. More with Michael Tisserand when we return. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. My guest today is Michael Tisserand. He's the author of Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White. It's a biography of George Harriman, the brilliant creator of the comic strip Crazy Cat, which ran in American newspapers from 1913 to 1944. Harriman was developing his strip during a time of enormous cultural change and artistic innovation. The seeds of jazz were taking root, first in New Orleans and then moving north to Chicago and New York. In 1913, the same year that Crazy Cat debuted, Louis Armstrong was learning to play the cornet in a juvenile delinquency home. And in New York, 1913 saw the opening of the International Exhibition of Modern Art, which shocked the country, but marked the dawn of modernism in American art. During the course of that show, which was held at an armory on Lexington Avenue, Americans got their first look at the work of European artists like Gauguin, Van Gogh, Matisse, Picasso, and others. But the painting that inspired enormous excitement and controversy was Marcel Duchamp's Cubist masterpiece, Nude Descending a Staircase. That painting became fodder for the cartoonists of the day. Still, many of them, like Harriman, were inspired by the revolutionary new approach to painting and drawing.
Harriman certainly went to the Armory show. There's no guest log of names of people at the show, so I can't say that with 100% certainty. But it's very clear they all did. All the cartoonists,
where they saw Gauguin, they saw Matisse, Picasso, Marcel Duchamp.
Nude Descending a Staircase. Yeah. That was the comic that that was infuriating to audiences the same way that Crazy Cat would be infuriating to newspaper readers for the next 30 years. And it's also worth noting that this was not like some kind of highbrow, lowbrow split here, the way we might like to look at it. Like, oh, the cartoonists were doing lowbrow work and they went to go to this highbrow show. Because the cartoonists also painted. Many of them did. Rudolf Dirks, who did the Katzenjammer Kids, had his paintings in the Armory show. Walt Kuhn, who was a cartoonist, was one of the organizers of the Armory show. So this really emerged from the same world that Harriman was working in at that time. And as a number of the cartoonists, Harriman and Tad Dorgan and others, would have fun with in the newspaper pages, the kinds of revolutionary work that was causing viewers to gasp in horror and shock was really the kind of work that the cartoonists were doing in the sports pages and comics pages already, showing movement, in kind of a surreal fashion, or showing multiple perspectives. Tad Dorgan would show a pitcher winding up and show that same kind of motion line and multiple perspectives and break the figure apart in really the same kind of ways that we saw in the Armory show.
As Crazy Cat developed, and you think about the influence that modern art show may have had on mm-hmm. people like Harriman. How do you describe how that made that way into his cartoons in terms of the setting of the cartoons, the consistency or inconsistency of the backgrounds, the dialogue? How do you put all that together? How would you describe that in a general way to us?
It seems that everything that Harriman was doing at that time, everything he was reading, the Armory show is one of his experiences, but someone who was a friend of his, who I did get to interview, said he was always had a book at his side, that everything he was reading, everything he was experiencing, and his early biography of being a Creole of color from a free people of color family in New Orleans that now was living in a world that only recognized black or white, and this sort of gut-level awareness that I feel like Harriman must have had that doesn't really capture much about who he is and who other people are, that language itself needs to be interrogated and questioned constantly on whether or not, on what do we mean when we say someone is black? What do we mean when we say someone is white? What is this study of black and white that we're so confident about? And all of this started finding its way into Crazy Cat for some reason. Crazy Cat became the vehicle that he could open up and expand and fill with all this content. It started out really sort of simply in 1913, the daily strips. It actually started after the Armory show, especially with Nude Descending a Staircase causing such a stir. The New York Evening Journal, William Hearst newspaper in New York, one of his newspapers in New York, started running a vertical strip along one side of the daily comics page. And many of the strips at that time were done by multiple cartoonists, Winsor McCay, George Harriman, and others. And they were lampooning this nude descending a staircase. One of the first Crazy Cats was Crazy Cat running down a staircase. And they would play with the idea of vertical space on that page. And then when Crazy Cat started in 1913, there was a lot of vaudeville and a lot of minstrel show humor. But that humor, too, is really based on malapropisms and language gags. And it really kind of fed into that same decentering project that Harriman went on of not being sure, you know, of the black coffee being black if you look under the milk, or, you know, not being sure of what it is we're talking about, what it is we're holding in our hands, what it is we're looking at, who it is we're looking at. And with Coconino County, his imagined world set in northern Arizona, which, by the way, was, I hate to use the word surreal, because I think that Harriman maybe influenced the surrealists more than the surrealists influenced Harriman. but this kind of surreal scene where as these characters are going about their business, the landscape itself is not stable, and you see the landscape kind of shifting back and forth as they're talking and as they're acting. And sometimes the landscape would take on its own life. Ignatz might be puzzled about something, and behind him a cactus raises up its arms, sort of mimicking Ignatz's behavior. So foreground and background, it's all put into play.
I'm looking at one Crazy Cat strip that is pretty elaborate. It looks like it's got 15 or 16 cells, and it's they're of course out in that Monument Valley territory, Coconino County, that he created, and it's Ignatz is just carrying a door. You know this one? He's carrying a door, and we first see Crazy Cat say, "Oh, that poor little dormice," and he follows him around, and Crazy cannot figure out why Ignatz is carrying this door around. At one point, he knocks on the door that Ignatz has up there, and Ignatz says, "Come right in." And Crazy says, "Or out," which is such a wonderfully surreal notion of a door that's freed from a house. Is it out or in when you go in? But the backgrounds, as you point out, keep changing. And in the last cell, there suddenly pops up on the landscape what appears to be a pagoda out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. So he did that sort of thing all the time.
You know, you read these very well. If they ever do an audiobook of Crazy Cat strips, Bill, I'm going to nominate you.
Oh, well, thank you, Michael.
and it was, I have to say, too, if you, people still to this day go, you know, I try to read Crazy Cat, I don't quite get it. Reading the strips out loud helps a lot. And, you know, as you describe them, the wonderful absurdities of the strip kind of pop out in a way, because the language is dense, because the writing has all this this cross-hatching, this kind of shadowy ink work. It's very dense to look at on the page. And reading it out loud really does bring it to life. When I first realized I wanted to write the biography of Crazy Cat, I was at an art show in Milwaukee that had George Harriman original panels on the wall. And I was carrying my son around. He was, I think, 3 years old at that time. And I was reading the strips out loud to him. And they came to life in an extraordinary way. So I just want to recommend, if people are going to dive into Crazy Cat, I recommend, even if people look at you like you're crazy with a C, is trying to read these strips out loud, because Harriman's jokes really come to life when you do.
I want to talk a little bit about how Charlie Chaplin inspired Harriman, because I think that The Little Tramp brought out in Harriman some of his most inspired thinking about who we are, what is life all about, how do we fit in to this larger pattern. He talks about Chaplin in the picture The Gold Rush, and the language is beautiful. "We have waited too long to catch," and he spells it with a K, "this sprite at play. So let no one stay our step while we have him. We will follow whither he wills until he loses us in the mists and we flounder back to earth again." That in itself is such a beautiful description of people's affection for Charlie Chaplin's Little Tramp. But then you share with us language from a panel that he did of Crazy Cat in 1917. Do you mind if I read this too?
Please do.
"You have written truth, you friends of the shadows, yet be not harsh with Crazy. He is but a shadow himself, caught in the web of this mortal skein. We call him Cat with a C. We call him Crazy with a C. Yet is he neither. At some time will he ride away to you, people of the twilight. His password will be the echoes of a vesper bell, his coach a zephyr from the west. Forgive him, for you will understand him no better than we who linger on this side of the pale." Oh my gosh, Michael.
Yeah.
That's
gorgeous. Isn't it beautiful? I have read that so many times. This word sprite, which I think Harriman got from Shakespeare. I think he got it from The Tempest.
Yeah.
There's a scene in Frank Capra's autobiography where he goes to the Hal Roach movie studios where they made Laurel and Hardy movies and Our Gang movies. And Harriman had friends there and actually set up a drawing table and did a lot of his work there. And it's one of the only times we have someone going up to Harriman and just asking him the questions that we'd like to ask him. And Frank Capra goes up to Harriman and says, What is going on with Crazy Cat? Why is Crazy Cat both male and female?" And Harriman says, "Well, I tried it the other way. You know, I even tried drawing a few strips where Crazy Cat was a female and got pregnant or something like that. And you know, it didn't work. And I realized that I wanted Crazy Cat to be a sprite, free to butt into anything. You know, to give Crazy Cat sort of the ultimate freedom." You know, and it's just as he looks at Charlie Chaplin, the ultimate freedom for this tramp, this little city tramp, to drop down in the middle of the Alaskan gold rush. And for Crazy Cat, the ultimate freedom to interpret a brick the way the crazy wants the brick interpreted, to take a husband or to take a wife, to change color, and to end the panel no matter what happened, and the final panel with hearts shooting up out of Crazy's head with the phrase "little darling." That's what I think that is something that Harriman drew out of early Charlie Chaplin comics. And Tad Dorgan said that you could almost never get Harriman to stop talking about Charlie Chaplin, how much Harriman loved Chaplin. And I think he drew a lot of not just inspiration, but perhaps permission from Chaplin. Because here's Chaplin creating very personal works of art within a very popular medium. And Gilbert Seldes, this critic that did a book called The Seven Lively Arts, talked very much about Chaplin and Harriman as being these examples of someone who can create a work of art within something that at that time was considered not art. You know, the movies or William Hearst newspapers, for gosh sakes. But could take a very personal story and tell it in a very unique way, which Harriman saw from Chaplin. And then now, years later, so many cartoonists and writers are turning to Harriman as an example of how he could do that kind of thing and being inspired by him.
We don't wake up looking forward to reading a comic in the daily newspapers the way you do.
Well, no. I mean, I do stubbornly subscribe to print newspapers, and I do read Pearls Before Swine and Mutz, which is a lovely strip. And Mutz, like Crazy Cat, may not have a punchline at the end of every strip, but it's always a scene of love and grace, I think, and others. But no, I know your point is taken, that newspaper comics are on a tough road right now. But there are other comics and cartoons, both on the web or in graphic novels. You know, like Art Spiegelman's Mouse owes a debt to Crazy Cat, and Harriman's influence has spread wide.
Michael Tisserand, your book is Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White. I loved reading about the Crazy Cat that I never knew and now recognize as being so important to our lives even today. Thanks so much for joining me for this conversation.
Thanks, Bill. It was great to talk crazy with you. Thank you.
information about Michael Tisserand's book and some samples of Crazy Cat cartoons on the Two Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. That's about all the time we have for this week's show. Remember, if you can't be near a radio when we're on the air, subscribe to our podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. Our senior producer is Jenny Ament. Our producer is Olivia Rheingold. Jenny and Olivia edited this week's show. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street. Thank you.